From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Tanya Mosley. It's Here and Now. So what exactly went wrong in Iowa? The state's Democratic Party issued a statement this morning trying to explain why the first in the nation presidential contest of 2020 ended last night without any public results. The party says a new smartphone app used to report precinct results recorded votes accurately, but only recorded out partial data. Democratic officials blamed it on a coding issue and said the plan is to announce who won the Iowa caucuses as soon as possible today. NPR's Miles Parks joins us now. And Miles, what more do we know about what went wrong last night?
So what went wrong really had to do with the results here. So the state party in Iowa unveiled this new smartphone app. This was supposed to decrease the amount of time. It's kind of hard to imagine now, but it was supposed to decrease the amount of time between people actually caucusing and the public getting the results. The precinct leaders at more than 1,600 precincts across Iowa were supposed to use this app on their smartphone, and it was supposed to transmit the results to the state. We heard about a number, dozens, over 100 problems with different officials trying to log into the app, having trouble downloading the app. So then once we got there, there was a backup system in place involving telephones that also had a problem. So all of this ended up just basically backing up the amount of time to the point where we still don't have any results at this point.
Can you tell us a little bit more about that phone system that was supposed to be one of the backups? Precinct captains have reported that they were on hold for hours trying to report their results. Why did the phone system fail?
Yeah, it's still a little bit unclear right now. Before the caucuses a few weeks ago, as I was reporting a story about this app specifically, that was one of my questions. Basically, what is the backup system and is it going to be good enough to where in a case where the app completely shuts down, will it be able to take that, you know, over 1,000 phone calls coming in basically at the same time? The answer we got last night was basically no. I talked to the state party around 6 p.m. Eastern time last night and asked, you know, how many people do you have working the phones for when this caucusing starts? I was really surprised to hear the state official wouldn't give an exact number, but said, you know, we've got somewhere around a dozen working the phones right now. And just doing the math there, 1,600 precincts, you know, a dozen or maybe a few more than that working the phones, you can see how this backup occurred pretty easily.
I want to go back to something that you just said. You, along with Iowa Public Radio, had reported on the use of this app a month ago. And as you said, people knew that there could be problems. When you all went to officials with the potential for problems, what exactly did they tell you?
It was clear that they thought we were kind of overreacting, that we were making a big thing out of something that they said was going to work beautifully and that was going to really make the caucus a more efficient and accessible exercise. We got no details on the kind of practice that caucus leaders were going to get on the app. We do know that from reporting and talking to caucus leaders, they did not have access to this app a month ago. This was just a couple weeks ago that they got their first look at it. And when you think about how complicated, you know, any elections are to run, that could be a pretty overwhelming experience if it's technology you've never used before or have only practiced with maybe once or twice.
The party says that this was not a hack of the system. How confident are people that eventually the reported results will actually be trustworthy?
I think people are really confident in that by the end of this process, that there will be a result that, you know, the party and the public can stand behind because there's paper. Everybody who went to caucus last night had to fill out a presidential preference card. And the party is kind of falling back on those preference cards to be able to say, we had some issues transmitting the results either by the phone or the app, but we can look at these cards and basically replay what happened in each one of those caucus rooms. The problem is that the Iowa Democratic Party has lost a lot of credibility in the last even, you know, say, year. Just a few months ago, there was talk about them trying to institute some sort of mobile phone or telephone caucusing option, which cybersecurity experts kind of universally panned. And then a few months later, they kind of institute this app, but without giving any transparency at all. So when the party comes out and it's going to inevitably say, whenever we get results, that this is the result and you can trust us, obviously a lot of people in the public are going to, you know, have a few more follow-up questions.
And we're hearing also that there are plans to use this same system in the Nevada caucuses, which are scheduled for February 22nd. What questions will need to be answered in the next few days.
If anything like this is going to be used in Nevada, I think you can expect there to be some really tough questions about, first of all, who wrote the software? Who developed it? We still have not gotten a public answer from the state party about who wrote the code for this app that was used last night. This is a really important step, cybersecurity experts say, to being able to have confidence in any system. You want to know that the people who created it are people who have security kind of at the front of their mind. The other thing is we want to know what kind of security tests and what kind of pressure has this been put under? Have they had a big statewide test with a bunch of people trying to log in at the same time? And are they positive that something like this is not going to happen again?
That's NPR's Miles Parks. Miles, thank you very much for this update.
Thank you so much.
President Trump delivers his State of the Union address tonight. He's already commented on Iowa on Twitter, saying the Democrat caucus is an unmitigated disaster. Nothing works, just like they ran the country. Tomorrow, his own two-week impeachment trial is expected to draw to a close, with senators deciding whether to remove him from office for abuse of power and obstruction of Congress. What a moment in time. What a moment for Julian Zelizer, professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University. He joins us regularly to look at these moments through the prism of history. Hi, Julian.
Thanks for having me.
And we always think, this has never happened before. This is crazy, no matter what it is. Can you think of a time with a State of the Union and an impeachment trial?
Absolutely. President Clinton was in office, and in 1999, he was also facing impeachment. His lawyers were preparing to make their case to the Senate, and he had to deliver the State of the Union address, and he did. Yeah. And he made one that didn't focus on impeachment. It focused on the economy. Many Republicans shook their heads while he was speaking. Some Republicans boycotted the State of the Union, but he went through with it. And overall, it was considered pretty successful.
Well, and also we've been hearing about it, of course, over the course of the day. And, you know, he was greeted warmly. There, you know, wasn't the venom maybe in the room that you might expect during the impeachment, maybe some head shaking. What's your anticipation of tonight? This is a president who, I mean, we hear his aides are begging him, please don't talk about this. The impeachment, what do you expect might happen?
Yeah, well, since until now, he hasn't really done what Bill Clinton did, meaning Clinton focused on governing while Congress was impeaching. Trump's position is more to go after the investigators. And now this comes at the end of the process. So he's all but acquitted. And in his mind, he will want to boast and he will want to almost clap back at Speaker Pelosi, remembering the famous clap from last year's State of the Union. So I expect a lot of it will be somewhat robotic, and he'll talk about the economy and he'll talk about how great the country is doing. But it's hard to imagine he won't get at least one quip in that he's still standing after this is all over.
Well, and his backers might say, and good for him. You know, Clinton had high approval ratings all during his impeachment. Trump does not. I don't think he's had one day where he's had a high approval rating. But he has something else. He has a ferociously fierce, devoted base. What do you say to them who say, he should. He's being acquitted. This is twice that an investigation has not come to the conclusion that his detractors hope it would.
Well, as a historian, you could say, well, a president wants to look beyond that and he wants to use a moment like this to try to unify, or he wants to show as another election approaches that he can be a big consensus builder and get beyond the turmoil. But the political analyst says that's not what he's going to do because, A, he has the kind of base that didn't really exist back in 1999, even for an already polarized Republican Party, and he has an entire media, conservative media apparatus on which to broadcast a tougher message. So that's, I think, why there are incentives for him not simply to be optimistic and bipartisan, but also to add a little bite to this speech.
Yeah. And by the way, yes, we know of another time when there's a State of the Union and an impeachment trial. But how about another time when there's a caucus, an important caucus that has a technical fail in the middle of an impeachment trial? I mean, talk about that moment in history.
Yeah, you can't make it up. There's obviously been Iowa caucuses that aren't resolved right away in 2012. The Republican caucus took some time, and last in 2016 there was fighting over the results of the Democratic caucus. But this, with an app that's not working and it's unclear even what's going on in the calculations in the middle of everything else, is quite remarkable. And it's obviously causing a lot of consternation for some Democrats who were hoping this was the beginning of the next chapter rather than kind of getting more into the mud of the current moment.
But again, as an historian, there's a good chance we'll be looking back and saying, what happened in Iowa? I mean, it might not matter.
It might not matter. Not looking back, it might not matter within a week. Yeah. And I think Democrats have to stay a little steady. Once New Hampshire happens, that will be the story.
Julian Zelizer, professor of history and public affairs at Princeton. Thanks as always.
Thanks for having me.
NPR's Code Switch is a podcast about race in America that's about all of us. Our histories, how we're represented, the ways we've worked together and worked against each other. You'll learn, you might get mad, you'll definitely laugh, but don't take my word for it. Just listen to NPR's Code Switch.
The Academy Awards are this Sunday, and the Netflix film Marriage Story is up for 6 Oscars, including Best Picture. Written and directed by Noah Baumbach, the film follows the disillusion of a marriage between Charlie, a New York theater director, and his wife Nicole, an actress. The couple earnestly wants to have an amicable divorce. Then lawyers get involved. Charlie is stunned to be served with divorce papers from the attorney of his soon-to-be ex-wife.
I feel like I'm in a dream.
We don't have a marriage anymore. I know you don't want the disruption, but you don't want to be married. Not really.
But I don't want this.
That's Oscar nominees Adam Driver and Scarlett Johansson as Charlie and Nicole. Noah Baumbach is up for Academy Awards for producing the film and for Best Original Screenplay, and he joins me now in studio. Welcome and congratulations.
Thank you.
So this isn't your first film that looks at divorce. There was also the 2005 acclaimed film, The Squid and the Whale. Why is this a topic, one that you decided that you wanted to return to now?
Well, I didn't think so much consciously about it when I started writing this. In a way, it felt like a fresh subject to me again, because I think I was thinking of this movie as a love story and a way to explore marriage. And just because something is over doesn't mean it failed.
The love is still there even despite it.
Right. And that was something we were always very conscious of throughout the movie, no matter how contentious things get between Charlie and Nicole and the lawyers, that love was always present.
This was not a conscious choice for you to do another movie about divorce, but you are a child of divorce and you've gone through it yourself. We also read that you did a lot of research for this film. It wasn't just something that you personally had gone through, talking to divorce attorneys and judges. Why was that important?
Well, because it is such a common thing in our— I mean, it happens to so many families. I mean, it, and this is such a big topic, and I want to hear from people in many different situations. I also interviewed people who've remained married for a long time, because I felt like, in a sense, that was as equally as relevant, because a couple in a long marriage has had to find ways to work through things and stay together. So that was equally relevant for me in terms of the research. And as you were referencing Squid and the Whale, it was very much from the child's perspective. And by nature, there's an innocence in that. And there's an innocence from the adult's perspective, too, as we see in this movie. Yeah. But, it was, for me, a kind of very different way and a very different story when looking at it from a grown-up perspective.
Yeah. So that's true about an innocence in the adults, because they're entering into something they've never done before. So they're experiencing all these things for the first time. So that was definitely intentional for you, for there to be that sense of sort of wonder as they were unpacking the process.
Yeah. I was thinking, I mean, even in sort of traditional stories like Homer's The Odyssey, or Candide, they're people who are going, they start in a place of innocence, and then they go through an adventure that often is quite crazy and surreal and mad. Yeah. And because of this, particularly the divorce system in America and the legal system, it can be extremely scary for people. Yeah. It's extremely shocking. It's confusing. But also narratively, it could work in a sense as a representation of what, you know, we often face in our lives, when our personal lives intersect with the sort of professional commercial industrial complexes.
Yeah. So there is a scene when Charlie visits the LA attorney, and it almost feels as if Charlie is small. And yeah, I actually think the attorney is standing up as he's talking to him.
I charge $950 an hour. Ted is $400. If you have a stupid question, you call Ted. To start, we'll need a $25,000 retainer.
Oh, that's more than
I can. In all your financials, we need to do a forensic accounting.
Which runs anywhere from $10,000 to $20,000.
In a way, the attorneys felt like caricatures, even though they were pretty nuanced. Am I right in that? Were they over the top?
Well, I think there is an element in the movie of performance. I mean, it's introduced in the beginning of the movie in that, as we learn, Charlie and Nicole actually come from a profession of performance. They're theater people. And so what I thought was interesting about that was this sort of notion that the lawyers themselves are performers. In the beginning, we meet them. They're essentially job interviews. They're auditioning for the job.
They really are.
And so they're presenting a kind of way of being, a persona. In the case of Nora, Laura Dern's character, that her scene with Nicole, Scarlett's character, is almost a seduction scene.
Let me get this out of the way. I think you're a wonderful actress.
Thank you.
I loved All Over the Girl, but the theater stuff, too.
You saw the theater stuff?
I was in New York last year for my book, which reminded me to give you a copy, and my publisher took me.
Great. Thank you.
You are awesome.
In the scene that you were referring to with Charlie and Ray Liotta's character, Jay, there's something more overwhelming. He's very tough. He's presenting a kind of, I'm going to fight for you. And it's nothing that Charlie wants to hear at that moment because it feels very aggressive.
Yeah.
So I don't think you're wrong in that, in sort of picking up that these are people who are sort of presenting themselves as kind of avatars, like I will be your avatar. And we see that as the movie goes along. Charlie and Nicole, in many of the scenes, quite literally are voiceless. They're sitting in silence while these people speak for them.
Yeah. I was immediately struck, and I think many of those in the audience as well, by how I sympathized with both of them. This is not something that we've seen in previous movies about marriage. So there are no bad guys here. I'm guessing this was very much intentional.
Yeah. And in many ways, a reason to make the movie was to present two sides of a story that are equally sympathetic and imperfect, but sympathetic.
And two humans who are flawed.
Absolutely. And people who've gone through it often have the reaction of like, oh, yes, yes, yes.
Yeah.
And then people who haven't are very surprised. Wow. I can't believe this goes on.
Right.
And that's, in large part why I wanted to sort of put sunlight on this thing, which is not spoken about that often, actually. For as common as divorce is, this sort of process and system is not really discussed.
It's so true, Noah. We have conversations with people. We have friends who are divorced, and they just will say, like, it's one of the hardest things you'll ever deal with in your life. But to actually see it and see how it can happen, how it can unravel in the process, this really captured that.
Well, I think Alan Alda's character, Bert, has a line. He says it's like death without a body. Mm-hmm. And I think not unlike death, there's a disbelief when it's going on. You're still in the other life, even though emotionally this person's still alive for you. They're on your phone.
Yep.
It's someone that you still believe they'll pick up if you call.
Wow.
And a marriage coming apart, a marriage going through a divorce, they're all still married. Hmm. I mean, they're actually still married while they get divorced. And we see that even in loving ways, that she still cuts his hair or he's still going to help her when her gate doesn't close. And they have this child, of course, that they have to raise, which is really the main struggle that, they'll
have to
go through and their main focus. There is this sort of ghost world and the present world.
Yep. And their families.
And their families.
We could talk about that for. Can you talk a little bit about the collaborative process? How did Adam Driver and Scarlett Johansson help you shape these characters?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, it was really Adam, I've had a relationship. We worked. This is our fourth movie together. So he was already very much inside it, both for me and for him. Scarlett, I reached out to and discovered in the process that she was actually going through a divorce, which was I thought was either going to be
a good thing or a bad thing.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And it turned out to be for her the reason to do the movie or a reason to do the movie. And there are jokes in the movie or things that are in the movie that I think are funny knowing you know, Laura Dern saying, sorry, I look so schleppy. I had an event at my kid's school. And then, you know, the line is, you know, of course, she looks amazing.
Yeah.
It, you know, knowing that's Laura, that gives me that line. That gives me that idea.
Mm-hmm.
But I, in effect, interviewed all of them about their own lives, you know, not just their experience with the subject matter, but also relationships, life. And they were just all so generous about contributing to things. And then we talk about their characters, of course, as well. And they had influence in that. But when I gave them the script, my hope was that it would feel familiar to them.
They'd see themselves
in it. They'd see themselves, yeah.
Yeah. Both you and your life partner, actress and director Greta Gerwig, have Oscar-nominated Best Picture films. Hers, of course, is Little Women. How much do you become involved in each other's filmmaking process?
Very much. But for both of us at the earliest stages, it's always an open conversation about what we're working on, what we're thinking. We'll both contribute thoughts, ideas. We read everything. We visit the sets. We come visit the editing room. I mean, it's a very communal in that way.
Yeah.
My feeling is we'd be fools not to take advantage. I'd be a fool not to take
advantage of her talent.
Of having Greta Gerwig in the house.
Yeah. Right, right. Is it a relief to not be competing in the same writing category?
Yes, that's nice. Definitely. But I also, I feel like, you know, any nice thing that happens to either of us is a nice thing for all of us.
It's a win for the unit.
Right.
This film and The Squid and the Whale are such thorough dissections of what happens when a marriage breaks down. Is this a topic you see yourself revisiting in the future?
I don't know. I mean, I think even though divorce is obviously a big part of both movies, they are both about family at large, and that's a pretty big subject.
Yes.
So I don't feel like I've said the last I have to say about family. Human beings are endlessly interesting.
There's so much. Yeah.
So I would never say I'm done with anything involving human experience.
Noah, thank you so much for taking the time, and congratulations.
Thanks so much. It was great.
The results of the Democratic Iowa caucuses are still unknown. State party officials spent all night and all day today dealing with the inconsistencies and technical problems in the reporting of the delegate totals. For now, candidates have already moved on to New Hampshire. The state's primary is on Tuesday. NPR national political correspondent Asma Hallett is in New Hampshire, and she joins us now. Hey, Asma. So Democratic Party officials in Iowa are manually tallying the results after technical problems with this new app. And we're now hearing that we should know more by 5 p.m. Eastern. Is that right?
That's right. That's us in a statement that the Iowa Democratic Party put out, as well as multiple campaigns that I've been in touch with.
All right. So you were at a Biden event earlier today. How did the Biden camp talk about this at the event you were at?
You know, it's interesting, and it was very different than what the mood of the party was at, like, last night in Des Moines. He said that they had a good night, but, you know, we got to be careful because we don't have all the results now. Now, I think what's interesting to note, though, Tanya, is that's the public messaging he's delivering to voters here in New Hampshire. If you look at what his campaign otherwise has been saying, though, you know, his legal counsel sent a letter to the Iowa Democratic Party yesterday saying that they had concerns about the, quote, considerable flaws in this system. You know, they have expressed some reservations, I will say, about this at that point in time. And, you know, I think one of the things that we should point out in general is that Joe Biden's campaign has always had relatively low expectations for Iowa. I talked to a campaign staffer over the weekend, and he told me that he felt they were the only campaign who could maybe finish third or fourth, and that would be okay. To hear a campaign openly acknowledge a possible fourth place finish, to me, is kind of unprecedented, right? But they've been saying that this is not just about Iowa. It's about the first four early voting states.
Okay. So I'm also thinking about without the results, there really are no winners or losers. What do you think this delay means for these Democratic candidates who are now in New Hampshire stomping there?
You know, I think that the candidates in particular who are particularly disadvantaged is those who might have actually seen a really good narrative if the headlines had said that they were the perhaps unexpected winner, or perhaps they had finished better than expected. They have now come to New Hampshire without those headlines. Instead, the headlines are chaos in Iowa, no Democratic results. And so, you know, if you're a lesser-known candidate in this field trying to get a boost, it's been really hard to get that boost in media attention, and now some of that is delayed. Now, if we get the results, you know, we'll get, it's expected to be a, quote, majority of the results, we've been told, around 5 p.m. Eastern time from the Iowa Democratic Party. You know, I'm unclear as to what narrative we'll see from that. It will not be the complete tabulation. One campaign told me that the Iowa Democratic Party told them that at this point, they are going around to check everything with paper ballots. They are driving around precinct to precinct to collect that data, and that they are also calling folks who have not yet actually submitted the precinct chairs who have not submitted the data either. So this is a pretty labor-intensive process that they need to complete.
Very much so. And as we move forward, we'll be asking some of those bigger questions about how this foul-up could end up hurting the future of the Iowa caucuses. That is something that lots of people will be talking about in the days and the weeks to come. That's Asma Khalid. She is NPR's national political correspondent. As always, thank you so much, Asma.
My pleasure.
This week, we're taking a look at science under the Trump administration. Yesterday, we spoke with Michael Girard from Columbia University's Law School, who's been tracking what he calls the silencing of science. He told us that silencing is beyond Orwell. His tracker and story will be at herenow.org. A spokesperson for the White House Council on Environmental Quality disagreed, telling us now more than ever, scientists have a seat at the table. But where is that table? That's the question today, as we take a look at the U.S. Department of Agriculture, specifically the Economic Research Service, or ERS. That's one of two sub-agencies the Trump administration relocated last summer from Washington, D.C. to Kansas City. Two-thirds of those USDA employees quit rather than move. Some are calling that a brain drain. Others are celebrating it. Mick Mulvaney, the White House chief of staff, called the resignations a wonderful way to streamline the government. Well, our next guest is squarely in the brain drain camp. Jamie Petruska is an historian at Rutgers, author of the book Looking Forward, Prediction and Uncertainty in Modern America. Professor Petruska, Jamie, welcome.
Hello, glad to be here.
Well, and you call the ERS essential. So for people who aren't thinking a lot about the U.S. Department of Agriculture, let alone this branch, the Economic Research Service, tell us why. Why is the ERS essential?
Sure. Well, this is a nonpartisan federal research agency that provides a massive amount of data on everything from forecasts of farm income to predictions of crop and livestock production, consumption, and trade to the forecasts of the consumer price index for food. So will specific items in the grocery store cost more or cost less? And these reports and forecasts are heavily relied on by Congress and other federal agencies, but really anyone who produces or consumes food in the United States, and that's pretty much all of us, is affected either directly or indirectly by the work of the ERS.
I want to go back a little bit because some would say there's quite an irony here because this is an independent research arm doing all the things that you just listed. And it came about because the Department of Agriculture was brought about to work against things like falsehoods, to try to find out what was true. Explain the history of this agency.
Sure, that's exactly right. Before the USDA was created in 1862, speculators could easily manipulate commodity markets by making inflated forecasts of a crop's yield if they wanted to make prices fall, or if they wanted to make prices go up, they would spread rumors of a crop failure. So in this regard, speculators had a lot of power over prices, and farmers had very little. And so in response to this really pervasive uncertainty and market manipulation, the federal government stepped in to create what was the first national agricultural statistics agency within the USDA.
Right. And let's just be more blunt, because you have been. I mean, these were hucksters. You've called them hucksters. They would make up stories about how big the cotton crop was going to be and thereby manipulate the prices. Are you saying we might go back to that?
Well, historians don't make predictions, but I think this provides a really important cautionary tale, in that even as the Federal Agricultural Statistics Program was expanding in the late 19th century, private firms selling their own crop forecasts could still wreak havoc on commodity markets. And one individual in particular, a British cotton forecaster named Henry Neal, depressed prices on American markets in the 1890s with these wildly inflated forecasts, all to make cotton cheaper for the British textile manufacturers who subscribed to his forecasts. And so he was a person who had nearly complete control over the American cotton market until the USDA investigated and discovered that he had, in fact, falsified his forecasts. Yeah. So in that regard, data and government statistical expertise was absolutely crucial to stabilizing what was a major part of the American economy.
It was a USDA statistician that sat down and found out that his cotton forecasts were based on completely falsified data, that he was a fraud. Look, talk about some of the research that's coming from the ERS today. We're looking, for instance, at research showing that SNAP recipients, people who got this food assistance, were not a drain on rural economies, they were actually a benefit in rural economies.
That's absolutely right. And the report you're referring to just recently came out to demonstrate that, in fact, the increase in SNAP benefits under the Obama administration had long-lasting positive effects on rural communities, so that when SNAP payments increased fourfold, some of that money went back into local economies, local grocery stores, and was actually instrumental to job creation in rural communities. So that research directly undercuts the rationale that the Trump administration provided in its attempts to scale back these benefits. And as you said, you know, they were arguing that this was a drain on national resources, but in fact, the opposite was quite true. Similar reports have come out recently to show that, in fact, climate change has serious effects on American agriculture. The ERS has provided data that shows that trade wars have, in fact, not been a good thing for farmers. And so critics of the recent move to Kansas City really point to these examples as evidence for the fact that the ERS is providing data that's really not politically convenient for the current administration.
Well, I know we have to ask the question. You know, the Trump administration is saying that this move and the fact that it reduced the staff of the ERS by so much is a good thing. I mean, as we said, Mick Mulvaney said it was a way of streamlining government. It was proposed by Sonny Perdue, Secretary of Agriculture, to streamline the government and save taxpayers, he said, $300 million a year. But are you suggesting that the move was actually to be a part of a suppression of facts in the government?
That's how I see it. And that's also how many critics of this move, from ERS staffers to agricultural scientists to the Union of Concerned Scientists, they're all concerned that, you know, while on paper it might seem that relocating and downsizing a federal agency will save taxpayers money, the long-term costs are incredibly severe. And the ERS is a group that works directly for lawmakers. And so it's very important for their reports to be circulated widely in Washington and for them to have face-to-face meetings with policymakers and their aides. And really moving them out to the Midwest takes them out of Washington, which is really a place where they very much need to be.
Well, what do you say to people who say, wait a second, we have people here in Kansas City? Are you saying that no city can match the research expertise in D.C. and, as you said, the face-to-face contact?
You know, I think the ERS is, it's attempting to fill the positions that have been vacated, but I think it's important to remember that the civil servants in the ERS and in so many federal bureaucracies are career professionals who, you know, have worked for many administrations, both Republican and Democrat. And really what's lost in this brain drain that Mick Mulvaney celebrated is really decades of experience, of institutional memory. And what's happened is that not only are the reports of the ERS now delayed, some projects have been shelved entirely simply because the people whose expertise is necessary to carry out these studies are just no longer there. So as one ERS employee told Catherine Rampell of the Washington Post, without the reports from ERS, members of Congress will just have to use whatever information they get from corporate lobbyists to shape the laws that they write. And so, as we know, the large corporations that really control our food system are always in favor of less and less regulation. And so we've already seen E. coli outbreaks and foodborne illnesses, recalls of romaine lettuce and things like that. I think that consumers will have to think perhaps even more carefully about food safety as they're shopping in the grocery store.
That's Jamie Petruska, historian at Rutgers, speaking with us about the Economic Research Service, something you may not have heard about before, but the ERS. It was a branch of the U.S. Department of Agriculture that was relocated from D.C. to Kansas City. And of the 171 researchers and scientists, 99 declined the move. Jamie, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
And by the way, we reached out to the USDA for comment. A spokesperson there said that as of January 18th, the ERS had 121 positions filled. That's still down from 171 before the move. And they are relying on short-term contractors and other temporary measures, while over 100 active recruitments are in process. Well, tomorrow we'll take a look at the rollback of regulations at the Environmental Protection Agency as our look at the silencing of science in the Trump administration continues.
Hyundai said today it will suspend production in South Korea because of disruptions to its supply chain caused by the coronavirus. The company is the first auto manufacturer outside of China to take such a step as the number of people infected continues to rise. There's more than 20,000 cases reported in 25 countries and territories and at least 427 deaths so far. China's president declared a race against time to curb the spread of coronavirus and warned that officials neglecting their duties would be punished. But as health officials scramble to contain this virus, misinformation is also spreading online. Let's bring in Shireen Ghaffari. She's a reporter with Recode. Welcome to Here and Now, Shireen.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So you report that Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, and TikTok are full of misinformation about the coronavirus. What information are you seeing out there exactly?
Sure, all different kinds. There's been a lot about false reports regarding the origin of the virus. There's a popular hoax that the virus is actually a bioweapon that Chinese spies smuggled out of Canada. That's absolutely not true. There's another theory that there's already a vaccine, and this is all a setup to sell more vaccines, which is completely unproven. And there, you know, health authorities say there is currently no vaccine. People are working on one, but there's none available. And then some of the most dangerous ones, arguably, are hoaxes that purport fake cures. There's a false claim that if you drink bleach that can cure coronavirus, that is fake and harmful. And that's the kind that we're seeing some social media companies such as Facebook say they are trying to actively remove.
You know, in addition to trying to actively remove those harmful messages, you report that these tech companies are also scrambling to try to promote factual content. How is that working?
Yeah, so companies such as YouTube and others are trying to sort of elevate the authoritative, what they call the authoritative sources on this. So, for example, on YouTube, if you search for coronavirus, you before the search results, you will be pointed to a New York Times article as of last week that is, you know, very informative and up to date on the coronavirus epidemic. And then, you know, other apps like Twitter, for example, similar thing. If you search for hashtag coronavirus, you're pointed to, you know, health authorities, resources on it. And so that kind of sort of manual reshifting of the algorithm of kind of directing users to something that they may not normally be directed to, they're hoping will help in this situation.
Yeah. I'm thinking about how fast things are able to go viral. What is the reach of this information that that's out there on these platforms? Do we know if it's having an impact?
The reach is tremendous. I mean, Twitter said last week that 15 million, there's been 15 million tweets about coronavirus in the past 4 weeks alone. We don't have an exact number for how many kind of fake posts there have been, but in our reporting, we've seen you know, posts that have blatant lies in them rack up hundreds of thousands of likes and views easily across platforms like Twitter and Facebook and YouTube. So it's out there. It's making an impact.
The World Health Organization reported the first death of the virus outside of China on Saturday. It was a 44-year-old resident of Wuhan, China, who had traveled to the Philippines before he died. People are understandably hungry for information about this disease. These headlines just keep coming. So what should people know about the information they see online? How do you assess whether it's accurate?
Look to see, first of all, if the news that you're getting is from a reputable news source. And if you're not sure if it's a reputable news source or not, try to see who is being quoted as an authority in the articles. We saw a lot of these hoaxes citing experts who are not really experts. And, you know, you want to see organizations like the Center for Disease Control, like the World Health Organization. Those are authorities on the extent of the coronavirus. And not just some random person who's been quoted as a quote-unquote expert.
Yeah. You know, as so many of us know, social media is kind of perfectly designed to sow panic. I mean, that's the irony to this conversation that we're talking about misinformation about this disease going viral. I mean, is there any way to effectively police this? Or is there just a certain amount of misinformation baked into how social media networks operate?
Yeah, I mean, I think to some extent it's just like a game of whack-a-mole where if you're letting people say whatever they want on a platform, you're always going to have people who are going to say false things. But I think it's very valid to question what kind of information gets prioritized on these platforms. As you were asking, you know, how the algorithms work in terms of are you promoting correct statements or are you promoting statements that may be inflammatory or stoke fear? And also to ask these platforms, you know, what they're doing, even though they may not be able to be comprehensive, but what they are doing to minimize and reduce some of the most harmful false hoaxes out there.
That's Shireen Ghaffari. She's a reporter with Recode. Shireen, thank you.
Thank you.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.